From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Stephanie Lecce. Today on the program, what's behind the low graduation rates for African-American students at UWM? Then, as more Wisconsin high schoolers prepare to take the ACTs, some find issues with the exam.
The ACT science section is to real science what a tofu burger is to a Sobelman's hamburger.
Then a filmmaker credits a politician for inadvertently kickstarting a conversation his movie addresses.
Sarah Palin came out in 2009 and referred to coverage for conversations between patients and their physicians as death panels, and that called a lot of attention to this subject. And at the time, it was pretty painful, but looking back in retrospect, she gave us a great gift.
And we get an update on issues making tongues and tails wag in the animal welfare community. Lake Effect comes your way next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Stephanie Lecce. Thanks so much for tuning in today. A college education is seen as the key to joining the middle class in the country. Schools, organizations, and even the federal government have programs aimed at making college more accessible to people from low-income backgrounds. But increasingly, education leaders are concerned about what happens to lower-income African Americans once they get to college. Jamal Abdul Aleem is a freelance writer in New York who specializes in higher education. He's a Milwaukee native, a graduate of UW-Milwaukee, and formerly a writer for the journal Sentinel. Abdul Aleem read an article in the magazine Washington Monthly last winter about the issue of student progress and accountability. That article cited data that showed only 19% of UWM's African American students graduated within 6 years. And so Abdul Aleem decided to come back to his alma mater to learn why that's the case. The result is his Washington Monthly feature called Dropouts Tell No Tales. He tells Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke why he felt compelled to study the issue.
It struck me because, you know, I went to the school and I never really realized that the graduation rate for black students was that low. I know it was an issue. I always heard words like retention and things of that nature when I was there, but to see it actually quantified like that, it really took me aback. Secondly, as a journalist who was covering higher education and then being a graduate of the school, what I did was I pitched a story to the same magazine that ran that piece, Washington Monthly, and said, hey, I'm uniquely suited to kind of get you some qualitative data to go with this quantitative. You know, it's one thing to cite a statistic and say that, oh, the black graduation rate at UWM is 19%, but it's quite another to explore the reasons why. And so what I wanted to do was just to illuminate some of the issues as to why that statistic was what it was.
Well, and as you dug into the issue, did you go into it figuring that this dynamic was specific to Milwaukee, or were you at first under the impression that this might be a more broadly applied set of data?
I guess a little bit of both. I mean, having been a crime reporter in Milwaukee for years, I became intimately familiar with some of the sociological issues that make it tough to grow up there. In a low-income area. And so I knew some of those things were at play. But at the same time, you know, the question I sought to ask and answer was whether or not the graduation rate at UWM was the function of family and social issues at the community level, or was there some type of systemic or institutional issues that perhaps could be addressed, or perhaps the third option, of course, is that it could be a complex combination of both of those things. And so that was the question that I pretty much asked everybody that I met during my return, whether they be students or faculty or administrators, whether or not they thought it was, you know, one or the other or a combination of both. And as I suspected, before I even made the trip, many agree that, yeah, it's a combination of both of those things.
Well, and so let's speak to both of those things. First of all, I mean, you know, there are many that point out that the playing field isn't level well before the university level, that many African Americans are being set up for failure before they walk onto campus. How do you see that happening?
Right. I'm not an expert on the K-12 data, and you know, I can't throw statistics out, but what I do know is that when children go to schools and maybe the expectations aren't the highest, or maybe there's a lot of other issues, such as discipline issues, or a lot of students who are struggling with different things, it just kind of slows down progress. Those are some of the challenges that schools face when it comes to educating children at the K-12 level. And so if children are struggling at the K-12 level, either with individual issues or if they just happen to be in a school where there's a lot of children that are struggling with these issues, then it can kind of hurt their educational experience. And so by the time they get ready for college, they're more likely to be in a situation where they haven't had exposure to the kind of courses that would adequately prepare them for college, particularly when it comes to the subject of mathematics. And so that's kind of what you see going on. It's just, you know, even in the piece, you'll see students that talk about, hey, when I was growing up, this is what I had to deal with. You know, it might be scarcity of food, disjointed families, you know, other financial issues. And, you know, they struggle with all these things. And then by the time it's time to enroll in college, lo and behold, they're not quite ready. One thing about UWM, and this is a good thing, is that they consider themselves an access institution. And so they give a lot of students a shot who might not otherwise get a chance at higher education. Many of the students I spoke with entered UWM through what's called the Academic Opportunity Center that has a rich and storied history in and of itself that goes back to, I believe, the 1960s. But this basically gives kids a shot, you know, at college when, you know, maybe they're not all the way ready. And so part of what we see in the low graduation rates is, you know, they're expanding access to students who may or may not be ready. But what the institution says is, well, when we, you know, expand opportunity, we can't guarantee that everyone is going to be able to be successful with it. You know, that was the response. But then what my piece thought to explore was whether or not there were some things that, you know, institutions such as UWM can do with the population that they're serving.
I think you're right that technology can actually affect the chances of college success for African American students.
Yeah, actually, when it comes to math, for instance, UWM is exploring with this online type of math program where students kind of work at their own pace. But the research on that shows mixed results. You know, there was a recent paper that came out this year. In fact, it came out like a couple of weeks before I submitted the story. So it's all the way up to date. But it just says that, you know, the results are kind of mixed when it comes to that. And, you know, there's some other issues that UWM struggles with when it comes to having students get through the math requirements successfully. One of the things that I dealt with as a student, and that was repeatedly brought up by students I interviewed, was the fact that there's kind of this disconnect between the instructors and the students, because many of the instructors are like foreign nationals, right? They come from other countries, and that in and of itself is not a bad thing, but it can be a challenge if they have maybe not the best English. And if you're studying a subject that you're already struggling with, and then it's difficult to understand the instructor, then I think it just aggravates the situation.
Right. And I think you brought up your own example and said what really made the difference was when you took a math class at MATC.
Right. If I, you know, I couldn't pass it at UWM. You know, I tried a number of times. I failed once, and then I withdrew the other times because I was in danger of failing. And, you know, I don't know if this is a popular thing to say or not, but, you know, Myself, I dealt with the whole language barrier. It was difficult to understand the instructors. And so at MATC, I had an instructor who, born and raised in the United States, made perfect sense, you know, in terms of, you know, I could understand what he was saying. And I think that made the difference. There might have been some other factors as well. I mean, it was an intense course, you know, something like 2-4 hours a day for like 6 weeks. So I kind of treated it like a part-time job. But the institution, you know, UWM itself, you know, one of the last times I spoke with the chancellor, he said that UWM was exploring a partnership with MATC because they're more, they have more expertise when it comes to teaching math to students who have some of these challenges. Whereas UWM is, you know, their math department is focused a little bit more on research and not necessarily on the instruction. To UWM's credit, they did hire a coordinator whose job is to kind of look at what else is being done throughout the nation, you know, successful strategies for teaching remedial and then college-level math to students, you know, who have some of these challenges when it comes to preparedness. And so, you know, I applaud the university for that. Having covered higher education out in Washington, D.C., one thing you see is that, hey, there are examples of institutions that are doing things differently and getting some success. And so I hope that the efforts that UWM makes in this regard, you know, searching for solutions, that those pay off. Because, you know, it's quite sad when you have students such as the ones quoted in the story that I wrote who, you know, they can complete all the college-level work, but it's just this college algebra that gets in the way of their degree.
You also write that there's mixed reaction, especially within the administration, to the concept of offering separate academic advising or offering the opportunity for special academic advising for African-American students.
Right. You know, UWM, I don't know exactly how special UWM is in this regard. I don't think it's very common, though, but they have a system where, you know, you have black advisors for black students. There's also an advising center for Latino, Hispanic students, as well as, I believe, Southeast Asian and American Indian. And so, you know, the debate is, well, do we offer students, you know, advisors that share their ethnic background and may be perceived as being more understanding of students from that background, or should we have students, quote-unquote, mainstreamed? And I was impressed with the university's response. They kind of recognized that there's merits to both, and so they let it be an option for the students. In other words, if you want that culturally specific experience, you know, you want an advisor who shares your background, you can have that. And if you want, you know, just to go through the regular advising system, then you can do that as well.
Well, it is a really complex issue, and Jamal Abdul-Alim, thank you so much for helping shine some light on it for us.
My pleasure, man.
Jamal Abdul-Alim is a Milwaukee native and UWM graduate. He's now a freelance writer in New York who specializes in higher education. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke. Abdul-Alim's article, Dropouts Tell No Tales, appears in the current issue of Washington Monthly. There's a link from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take a quick break now, and then we examine the pros and potential pitfalls of the new ACT exam requirement for Wisconsin high schoolers. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Stephanie Lecce. Before the break, we explored what has made it difficult for many African American students to succeed in and graduate from colleges like UWM. Standardized tests, such as the ACT, are looked at by most schools as important measures of college readiness. But students often fear them, and some criticize the way the tests are written and devised. Nevertheless, more Wisconsin students than ever will soon take the tests thanks to changes in state education policy, which will next year make the ACTs a requirement for high schoolers. Craig Knurr has helped develop test prep apps and runs a Delafield company that helps students prep for exams like the ACT. He spoke with Mitch Teich about the impact that he believes the new requirement will have.
It's going to have both good and bad effects. The good effect is that every high schooler who goes to a public school gets to take the test, which means you're going to have more students that are going to be looking at college as an option potentially, which is a very good thing. Because a lot of students, I mean, it's $35 to take the basic test, $50 if you want to take it with writing. Particularly with low-income families, even though you can get that written off, doing all that paperwork is kind of a pain. And so what they'll do is, by letting everyone take it, these students now just show up and they take the test, and you've skipped over all those hoops and barrels and all those things.
So that the requirement is such that that it really takes that complication out of the equation.
Exactly. Now, the darker side, so to speak, is that now we are looking at the ACT as evaluating, in a sense, our curriculum. And that, even though it benefits me, is something I don't like because that means that we're looking at the ACT and perhaps brushing over its flaws. And that could present problems. For example, if we're evaluating our science teachers from the ACT, that could be problematic. Because I'll use an SAT analogy here, just because the ACT doesn't have them.
And the SAT is good at analogies,
yes,
as I recall.
Yes, yes. I mean, it kicked them out, but everyone still refers to the SAT as being the analogy test. But the ACT science section is to real science what a tofu burger is to a Sobelman's hamburger.
And that is an analogy I think people will grasp.
Yes.
Well, and so let's talk specifically about the science section because, you know, the rumor mill is flying with the idea that the student rumor mill anyway, that the science portion is the hardest. I would imagine all the sections are hard if you don't approach them the right way. But let's talk about the science section. What is it about that section that has so many kids dreading it? And why does that analogy work in your estimation?
Well, part of the reason they dread it so much is that the ACT science section is, for all intents and purposes, a reading diagram and data analysis section. Now, the difficulty is everyone says, oh, it's just, you know, data analysis. But it's really, as I like to say, the test of hasty generalizations, meaning you have to look at the stuff, make a decision really quickly. And that's where it's really bad science. Because science, if you're making hasty generalizations, well, we don't really want them. And so what happens is that students are being put into an environment that is not the exact same as they would have in a science lab.
This is counter to the kinds of lessons they're being taught, really.
Right. And the other thing is when you see a diagram in a textbook, you look at it and you're like, oh, this is what this means. And when you see a diagram on the ACT, you're like, oh, my goodness, I have to figure this out just now. What is this doing? And instead of it helping you, it's kind of like beating you over the head and frightening you half to death. It's like the boogeyman coming out of the closet. You turn the page. Oh, my goodness, what is this? And you're hoping to figure it out really quickly.
But there's presumably not a box you can fill in that says, I protest the whole supposition of this section of the test. So what is a student to do? You know, is there an effective strategy to get ready for a section of the test that is completely counter to the kind of stuff that they're learning every day in high school?
And I'll quickly insert one other reason they say it's the hardest. It comes last. So they're dead tired. So you've got 40 questions, 35 minutes. One of the things you want to be aware of is that you've got 5 minutes per passage. There's 7 total passages. The other thing is that some are going to be more reading intensive. Some are going to be more diagram intensive. And one of the things that I've done is we built a mobile app, which is a free app. And one of the things that we tell people in it is that when you're dealing with a graph, for example, mark the headings on the graph. It seems really crazy and the lines are going to be going up and down and in circles and you're going to have no idea what's going on. But if you look at the question, it's going to say, okay, you need to go to this heading number 5 and this heading 4.5. And then those two headings just kind of meet in the middle of the graph. You say, oh, well, this is where I am. And so if you actually label those headings, even though all sorts of insanity might be going on, you have a fighting chance to say, oh, okay, even though there's 18 graphs, I need the graph that has this thing and this thing. Awesome.
Is there a positive spin to this? What do colleges get out of testing students' science aptitude in this kind of strange way?
Well, one thing I've noticed is that a number of colleges do actually ignore the science section. Wisconsin colleges tend to be okay with it. And so what it's doing and what it professes to do is kind of evaluate how quickly you can reason and how comfortable you are with scientific jargon. One of the other things that we've put in the app, and you can find this in any textbook, we kind of simplified it in the app, is knowing that jargon. For example, most students have not taken geology. There are going to be questions about geology. Now, if you've taken environmental science, you might come across a little bit of that jargon.
So give me an example of the jargon that would come up in geology or environmental science.
You might be talking about, well, even just a fan, which in that case is a lake kind of spreading out and distributing the sand and fanning out. Or you might be talking about a fen, which is a form of a bog, except it's a little bit different. And so just seeing those, like, oh, okay, I'm kind of going into a swamp, and being comfortable with going through those types of terms.
And swamp would be another good analogy to use in this case, because I would imagine some of the students feel like they are really going into a swamp when they
Indeed.
Do that part
yes,
of the test.
Yes, they get quite bogged down.
You know, so this actually gets at the heart of issues that have been bandied about a lot. I mean, there's a lot of backlash against standardized high-stakes testing. How do you feel about the place of reading into the data that comes out of tests like this versus measures of other kinds of thinking and imagination?
Well, it's difficult to really set up a good test for any of those things. What you want to do is take it with a grain of salt. For example, the reading section of the ACT, for the most part, is a glorified word search. There are going to be about 5 real reading comprehension questions. The rest are, did you find this thing in the passage? The other thing that is notable, when you're going through the test, the reading comprehension of almost any section is, did you answer the question? And that's a very particular thing. A lot of the times, and this happens in conversation, someone will say something to you like, hey, I understand you. And you really comprehended maybe 10% of what they said. Well, when you do that on a standardized test and they're saying, did you answer the question? You're like, oh, yeah, I got the meaning. And you didn't actually comprehend the question. That's when you run into problems. So it's a little bit tricky, but in terms of evaluating students for college, again, that grain of salt saying, okay, it's a certain realm of skills, but certainly not all of them.
In addition to the fact that all Wisconsin high school students will soon deal with this requirement to take the ACTs, and I say that that's sort of a value judgment there, but they will all have to take the ACT. There's been an increase in the number of students taking both the ACT and SAT as well. Do you think that's a wise idea? These are really different tests.
They are different tests, and for some students, it's a really good idea. From what I've seen and from what has been pretty much seen nationally, about 25% of students are going to test better on the ACT, 25% are going to test better on the ACT, and 50% it's pretty much a coin toss. But it's good to look at both to kind of go through and say, okay, which test is a better representation of me for when I'm applying to college? And one of the ways you can tell that is taking the PSAT. And that's one nice thing about next year is that every high school student in a public school can take the PSAT and the ACT without paying extra for it. But what they can do, and there's a PSAT in about 2 weeks, around the 18th or so. But one of the things that they can do is take that and look at their ACT and say, okay, which did I like better? And which one can I perhaps perform better on? And also, if I study, which one might I perform better on?
Given that the students will be required to take the ACT, as students are taking both the ACT and PSAT, if it turns out that they're really not geared up to take the ACT well, does it behoove them to put all of their eggs in the SAT basket even though they're still going to be required to take the ACT?
For sure. Yeah. There's no sense in forcing a round peg into a square hole. Let it fit as it fits. And, you know, square peg, square hole, round peg, round hole.
Well, Krakener, thank you so much for helping us keep the square pegs and square holes and round pegs and round holes straight.
Well, thank you for having me.
Craig Knurr runs Knurr Learning Center in Delafield and has helped develop a variety of apps designed to help students prepare for standardized tests like the ACT. He spoke with Mitch Teich. Coming up, we'll speak with a filmmaker behind an important documentary on talking about death and dying. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Stephanie Lecce. Death is universal, but so is the seeming reluctance to talk about it. But why? Two local filmmakers set out to explain Americans' difficulty discussing the dying process and preparing for life's end. Michael Bernhagen and Terry Caldestall interviewed more than 100 experts and regular people from around the country. The result was the 2011 documentary Consider the Conversation. The award-winning film has aired hundreds of times on PBS stations across the country and is now out on DVD. And you can catch it at a local screening next week, sponsored by Horizon Home Care and Hospice. Horizon's Kelly Andrew joined filmmaker Bernhagen in studio with me earlier this year to talk about how the national conversation around death and dying has changed since the film came out. Bernhagen began by talking a little bit about the project's mission.
This film is an intimate story about the American struggle with communication and preparation for end of life. And it contains the perspectives of people going through that process, terminally ill patients and their families, and the people who care for them, their doctors, their nurses, their social workers, their clergy, and some very prominent national experts in end-of-life care. And it's important to understand that this film does not give any particular answer. It's not a hospice film, for example, and it's certainly not a film about physician-assisted suicide. What it does is it gives the viewer some of the questions that they and only they can think about and answer for themselves. For example, when it's your time to die, where would you like to be and with whom? What kind of care would you want? Why is hope not the same thing as having a plan? What's next? What does quality of life mean to you? Who should be responsible for leading us through this conversation? And what matters most to you at end of life? How would you like to live at the end of your life? And as such, this film, I think, aligns beautifully with the concept of advanced care planning because of that focus. And advanced care planning is all about the process of talking with people about how they want to live at the end of life, documenting those wishes, and aligning care with those wishes when push comes to shove.
Michael, one of the interesting points that was brought up during the interview that you and Terry did with Bonnie North a couple of years ago when the film first came out was the idea that the way that we die today has changed from the way we've died in the past.
Absolutely. The reason I think our culture struggles with talking about end of life is because of American medicine's success at fighting disease and extending life. By that I mean where we die has fundamentally changed. 100 years ago, most of us died at home surrounded by friends and family. Today, however, 75% of us can expect to die in a hospital or a skilled nursing facility. How we die has also changed. 50 years ago, most of us died suddenly from heart attacks, accidents, and strokes. But today, most of us can expect to die slowly and incrementally from one or more severe chronic diseases. And we've increased average life expectancy by 7 years since 1970 alone. But that isn't necessarily lucky because increased quantity of life often comes at the expense of reduced quality of life for most people. Collectively, Terry and I refer to this as the problem of unintended consequences. That is, American medicine's success has created a void in our culture, a void that is often filled with fear, denial, and the illusion that death is somehow optional. And the result is unparalleled suffering, suffering that is certainly physical in nature, but it's also emotional, social, spiritual, and yes, sometimes financial.
I would agree. I think there's also a change happening right now with the baby boomer generation. As they age, they're much more determined to have things the way that they want and do things the way that they had planned rather than what a physician might say or what, you know, someone else might advise them. So I really think end-of-life care and this conversation is going to come into play a great deal in the upcoming years because people aren't necessarily satisfied with the way we've always done things. People want change, and now's the time to talk about what the ideal end-of-life experience is, and that's different for everyone. I think that's one thing I've learned in hospice, is that each individual has a very different perspective on what they see as a good death.
One of the unintended consequences of American medicine's success is that we produced what seems to be system-centered care instead of person-centered care. By person-centered, I mean care that's tailored to the thoroughly discussed, well thought out, and understood wishes of the individual, whether that means aggressive treatment, do everything you can to keep me alive, I don't want to die, or whether that means comfort care like hospice care or palliative care, or some combination of the two for a certain period of time. In order to achieve that kind of culture change, however, I think our work with regard to the film has to do two things. Number one, it has to inspire the general public to think and talk and act upon these wishes. And number two, it has to inspire the medical system to create an environment in which these types of conversations are normal, they're operationalized, and they thrive. Therein lies the greatest challenge, I think.
Well, so then let me ask, Michael, what kind of response have you seen to the film since it debuted? I mean, it's obviously been shown on public television stations across the country. It's won awards. Do you see the conversation changing?
The response to the film is something that we could only have dreamed of, quite frankly, Stephanie. To Terry and me, the most important thing that has happened has been that our work has inspired the Wisconsin Medical Society to launch a project called Honoring Choices Wisconsin. That's a physician-led initiative that will make facilitated conversations about end-of-life wishes a standard part of patient care here in the Badger State. Basically, in this program, doctors will champion the importance of advanced care planning with patients at a time when they're not dying, when they're not in crisis, typically beginning at age 55 or when diagnosed with a serious illness. For willing patients, then, they'll be referred to a certified advanced care planning facilitator. That's someone who has the skills to conduct these difficult conversations, who has the time, because our doctors don't have the time, and who have the ability to meet with patients and families wherever they might reside. And then, of course, eventually there'll be extensive community outreach and education done by the Wisconsin Medical Society in collaboration with the medical faith, business communities, public media, and other important constituencies. Now, this project's going to take some time to unfold, Stephanie, because what we're talking about here is culture change, and culture change doesn't happen overnight. The first of three consecutive years of pilot projects will launch March 1st here in southern Wisconsin. There are seven integrated healthcare delivery systems who have agreed to participate in this project. But at its core, what it's really all about is preventing unnecessary suffering at end of life, suffering that, as I said before, is physical, emotional, spiritual, social, and yes, sometimes financial. And when you look at it in this context, Honoring Choices Wisconsin believes that talking with people about their wishes at a time when they're not dying is good preventive medicine, just like it is to take your child in to be immunized against measles, mumps, and rubella, just like it is to go in for your annual physical to get your mammogram, et cetera. So this is a really significant historical event process unfolding here in Wisconsin.
Kelly, from the perspective of Horizon Home Care and Hospice, when you see something like this being implemented statewide, what does that mean for the work that you're doing?
I think it's wonderful. You know, often when someone comes to hospice, a social worker can help have this conversation and move things forward. But it's interesting that more people don't have this conversation before that crisis begins. And I had an interesting conversation a few weeks back with an undergrad class at Concordia. And what I told them was, this is one of your rights. You know, you wouldn't want to give up your rights to make decisions for yourself. So it's really important that we all consider this. And I'm getting more and more requests coming in through Horizon for community presentations. People want to know more about how to do this, how to have that conversation. What are my rights? How specific can I get about my wants and needs at end of life? So I'm just thrilled that this movie is out there, and I think it is having a wonderful impact on people at least being open to hearing about what's available to them and how they can prepare for a time that's going to be very difficult, no matter what the circumstances, for them and probably for their family and loved ones.
I have to wonder if this film didn't come out at just the right time, that it seems like maybe there were other shifts going on coinciding with this film exploring this topic that really has been so taboo in our culture. What do you think has influenced making people more receptive to the film's message and really, as we've seen, having this huge impact on how we talk about end-of-life care?
It's a great question, Stephanie. Obviously, we've done a lot of research as we've put this film together, and one of the areas that we took a close look at was the psychology of adult learning. How does a culture move from ignorance on a particular issue toward mastery? And there's four different phases involved in that learning, if you will. And 4 years ago, we were at that phase, I think, in our culture that the folks in adult psychology would refer to as unconscious incompetence. That means as a culture we didn't know that we didn't know how to do these conversations. And then Sarah Palin came out in 2009 and referred to coverage under the healthcare reform proposal for conversations between patients and their physicians as death panels, and that called a lot of attention to this subject. And at the time, it was pretty painful, but looking back in retrospect, she gave us a great gift because it allowed us to kind of think about this issue
and how it's communicated.
And how it's presented. And so now 4 years later, I think we're at that very significant phase in our development as a culture, a phase that is referred to as conscious incompetence. That means we now know that we don't know. And therein lies the motivation to change, and we're seeing evidence of that right now.
Tell me about how individuals have responded to this, and Kelly, if you've seen any direct influence from this.
I think it's interesting. Anyone who sees it is going to now think about it. You can't help it. So when I invited my team from work over to my home and we watched the documentary and, you know, decided to chat about it afterwards, everyone that sees it that I've encountered says, oh, my husband and I need to talk about this. Or, you know, I don't quite know what I would want or what my thoughts are on this. And I've got to wrestle with that a little bit. So in my mind, anyone who sees this movie will be changed. And, you know, once you start to see that change happening, you also see bigger things happening. So more conversations taking place, more people who are educated about their rights in this, and will help drive our health system to embrace this and use it. So I'm very hopeful and encouraged by what I see with individuals who watch the movie.
So more people are talking. We obviously have this amazing initiative starting up here in Wisconsin very soon. But what's the next step, Mike?
Oh, well, Terry and I believe that our work is only just beginning. Recently, we began the second film in the Consider the Conversation series. It's subtitled A Documentary About Unintended Consequences. And it's a film that will focus on what we believe to be the fundamental building block on positive change with regard to this issue. And it will be about the patient-doctor relationship, what happens in that interaction, what doesn't happen, and probably what should happen. And these are 18-month projects making these films, and we're about a third of the way into it. And during the first production phase, we traveled throughout the country to talk with doctors. And these physicians have been sharing with us the stories of why they were called to become doctors. And many of them have become aware that the reason they became a doctor has changed. They were originally called to become a doctor to care for people. But unbeknownst to them, beginning with their medical training into residency and then, you know, joining a practice or a hospital organization, somehow the emphasis became on curing people. And that's caused tension. And they've realized that this is driven a wedge, unintentionally driven a wedge into the patient-doctor relationship. And so in phase two of our production, we'll be trying to capture the patient perspective on that relationship. And our belief is that if we can't get it right in that most fundamental and basic of human interactions, then other things that we do, legislation, reimbursement, policies, don't really matter.
Michael Bernhagen is Director of Community Engagement with Rainbow Hospice Care in Jefferson, Wisconsin. He's also a co-producer of the documentary film Consider the Conversation, alongside filmmaker Terry Caldestall. Kelly Andrew is with Horizon Home Care and Hospice in Milwaukee. Horizon is sponsoring a screening of the film on October 16th at Marcus North Shore Cinema in Mequon. You can find more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. From advocating for court case dogs to finding the lost dogs of Wisconsin, we learn about efforts to make sure man's best friend is protected. That's next when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Stephanie Lecce. When it comes to animal welfare in our state, the organization Wisconsin Voters for Companion Animals is often at the front lines. The group advocates for humane legislation and builds awareness about issues affecting our pets. Kathy Poblosky is the director of the group, but she also wears another hat as co-founder and director of Lost Dogs of Wisconsin. As its name suggests, this group helps reunite owners with their lost, beloved dogs. Just as the organizations share a director, they also share a common, if not precisely the same, mission: to protect our pets. Kathy Poblosky joins me in the studio now. Welcome back to Lake Effect.
Glad to be here.
Well, we have you in today to give us a little bit of an update on what's new in the animal welfare community. What issues are taking precedent today?
Well, we like to think of ourselves as the watchdogs of humane legislation, and we try to watch for things that are coming up. And we have six focuses: community cat management, commercial dog breeders and pet stores, animal cruelty, reforming animal control, and the court case dogs. And currently with the court case dogs, Senator Tim Carpenter has introduced a bill, and we are supporting that, that would improve conditions for the victims of cruelty in Wisconsin. And those are dogs that have been seized from cruelty cases in Wisconsin. And Senator Carpenter's bill would expedite the process by how those dogs are handled and treated.
So basically, just to explain for people who aren't familiar with the court case dogs, how do they end up in basically municipal custody?
For whatever reason, the owner is charged or accused. In the case of the current dogs in Milwaukee, the owner has not even been charged for some sort of act of cruelty. Sometimes it can be as simple as domestic violence. Sometimes it can be as complicated as a dog fighting ring. But again, you know, most of these dogs have not been involved in dog fighting. I really want to make that clear, because some people think of court case dogs and automatically assume that they were fighting dogs. And often that is not the case. As for the dogs that are currently being held in Milwaukee, many of those were just puppies when they were seized.
So what happens to these dogs?
They can languish for a very long time. Currently, 16 dogs are in the custody of Milwaukee Animal Control, and they have been there for over 2 years.
And the issue here is that these dogs are basically being held in limbo, correct?
That's correct. They're being treated basically as evidence, and just as you would drugs or guns or something like that, until a case comes to trial. But, you know, drugs and guns you can put on the shelf, you know, in a box on the shelf, where these are living being creatures that are being held as evidence for a case that has not even begun to happen yet. The owner has not even been charged.
So what would the Wisconsin Voters for Companion Animals like to see happen with these dogs?
Well, we would love to see a good resolution for those dogs right now that are there now. But going forward, we would like to see Senator Carpenter's bill pass so that this process can be improved for all incidences like this in the future, so that these dogs can be expedited through the process, become available for, you know, socializing by volunteers, for adoption by the public, so that they can go on and have a good life. And we always think of them as double victims. They were victims of cruelty, and now they've become victims of the system. And we would like to see them not become victims of the system.
I know this is an issue that your organization is working on, this link between animal cruelty, domestic violence, and animal welfare. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you're working on specifically to prevent this kind of situation?
Well, I think a big part is just awareness that there is a huge link between cruelty to animals and cruelty to people, that so often it's been proven time and time again that serial killers or people that go on to commit horrible crimes often began, you know, by being cruel to animals. And so that if we can get animal cruelty prosecuted to, you know, the fullest extent of the law, which isn't what happens now, we would have a much better chance of stopping some of the violence that goes on later on in somebody's life.
Now, I know that another priority for the Wisconsin Voters for Companion Animals is no-kill issues related to particularly to shelters. What progress have you made on that? What's your ultimate goal in addressing that?
Well, we call that reforming animal control, and sheltering in America is changing so quickly. Gone are the days where, you know, shelters had to kill the majority of animals that came into their care. In the 1970s, there was about 17 million animals killed per year in America in animal shelters. And now we are down to around 4 million, which is huge progress, but we would like to see that day when that number is almost zero. And of course, you always have to leave an allowance for those animals that are either dangerously aggressive or hopelessly ill. So the real definition of no-kill is that a shelter is, or a community is, saving upwards of 90% of the animals in their care.
Now, a few months ago, we had the new executive director of MADEC on, and she made a statement that kind of echoes what you've just said, the idea that her goal isn't to save every animal. If they're violent, if they're ill, if they're really not savable, you know, she's okay with putting them down. But her goal is to have all adoptable animals adopted out. What do you make of that?
Oh, absolutely. And that's, you know, the real key and to becoming a no-kill community is to do two things. One is to reduce the number of animals that come into your care, and one is to increase the number of animals that leave alive. And when you do those two things, you close the gap and you become a no-kill community. So even though you may not say that you're working towards no-kill, or, you know, you don't like the words no-kill, once you do those two things effectively and put together 11 programs called the no-kill equation in your community, then and you really embrace it and you get everybody on board, then you are working towards being a no-kill community, and you will achieve success.
Now, Kathy, you're kind of wearing a second hat here in this interview. You're the director of Lost Dogs of Wisconsin. Now, we've talked about this organization before on Lake Effect, but if folks haven't heard our initial interview with Lost Dogs of Wisconsin, tell us about the organization.
We are all volunteer-run organization that helps people that have lost their dog. So we're a virtual organization. We work via email, Facebook, and telephone to reach out to people that have lost their dog, to try to give them good advice, good support, to resources to help them get their dog back home. We have volunteers around the state that do everything from helping make the flyer, posting it on Facebook, putting it out on Twitter, putting it on Craigslist, to people that check animal shelters, check shelter websites, things like that. So we have a far-reaching network.
Give us an update. How's the group doing?
It is doing wonderful. And I brought along a few numbers. So we are almost to 20,000 Facebook fans. We started with 4 volunteers, and we now have over 60 official volunteers in Wisconsin. And we have dozens and dozens of unofficial volunteers, which are our fans that like to, you know, just check in on the page, match, do some matching on their own, or share our posts, or perhaps just look out for dogs that are missing in their community. And so as of this month, 2013, we have already reunited over 1,000 dogs in 2013. And we now have sister sites in several states, and that including Texas, Illinois, Minnesota, Colorado, Arizona, and Iowa. And we always like to think that for every dog that we send back home, we've saved 2 dogs. That dog that went back home, and then we've freed up the space in the shelter for another dog.
Tell us about the model and really how you've harnessed social media to grow this organization.
Facebook has been huge. It's been so... In the past, if there was many websites that were, you know, that have pictures of lost and found dogs on them. But with social media, the ability to be able to share it so easily. So even if we put a found dog on Facebook, even if the owner doesn't see it right away, the neighbor might see it. And the neighbor might say, oh, I know that dog. That's so-and-so's dog. And he'll call him up and say, oh, your dog is, you know, at such and such a place, or so-and-so has your dog. So the ability of Facebook to actually become this huge network of people that love animals and want to get them back home has been amazing.
Now, so far, there's Lost Dogs of Wisconsin, but is there an effort underway for cats?
Yes. Funny that you should ask that. There is. And when we started Lost Dogs of Wisconsin, a lot of people asked why we didn't include cats as well. And we were inventing the wheel. There was nothing like this had ever been attempted before in the nation. We had to focus our energy to make a difference because we thought we could make a difference. And we had to, you know, we were training new volunteers. And lost cat and lost dog behavior is very different. And our volunteers are very highly trained in lost dog behavior. So it was difficult to train new volunteers to 2 kinds of behavior different ones. So we decided just to focus on dogs. Also, with the way Facebook works, if you overpost, you risk Facebook hiding you in people's news feeds. So we were afraid that by overposting, by having cats and dogs, we would actually do ourselves a disservice by not getting out there as much as we needed to be in Facebook. But I'm thrilled to announce that there is a Lost Cats of Wisconsin being run by a woman up in northern Wisconsin. And we're asking everybody to like and share her page and her posts because we want to help get lost cats back home too.
Is there a success story that has stuck with you since becoming director?
I have so many. It's hard to even think of one. We had one where it was a young 17-year-old boy in Appleton named Bernardo, and he lost his beagle, and it was just heart-wrenching. The email updates we'd get, he was so sad, and he missed his dog so much, and he didn't have a car, and he was riding his bicycle from town to town to put up the flyers and check at the shelters, and he did everything that his caseworker did, which is our volunteer. And then sure enough, a few weeks later, his dog turned up in an animal shelter with a broken leg because it had been hit by a car. But he was just so thrilled. I mean, he rode his bicycle right there, right away to see his dog. And his dog ended up having to have its leg, I'm not sure it's been amputated yet, but it's under extensive care right now by a vet clinic. But just his story was really heartwarming, you know, and it actually made the local paper and then was picked up by Life with Dogs website. And when I last checked, it had like 5,000 shares on that.
What is that like for you when you hear these stories of people being united?
That makes our day. I mean, every day. Every day the volunteers get on the computer, you know, usually evenings or whatever where a lot of us are on. And it's just so heartwarming and to see and hear these stories. I mean, it just motivates you so much for the next day to start again and grab those cases and pick up the phone and try to help those people. Dogs do not fall off the face of the earth. They're out there somewhere. So if an owner does not give up, there's a really high chance that they will be reunited with their dog. Maybe not this week, maybe not this month, but sometime. And so our biggest goal is always to keep the owner going. That's our motto, never give up.
Well, Kathy Poblosky, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kathy Poblosky is the director of Wisconsin Voters for Companion Animals. She's also the director and co-founder of Lost Dogs of Wisconsin. I'm Stephanie Lecce. Great to have you listening on this terrific Tuesday. Join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.